Rob Wolf, Andy D's back, episode 36. What's going on? I hear you just got back from Mexico.
Got back from Mexico, had a great time, got invited to the LaRue Capuccio wedding. Wellborn and his girlfriend Kate were there, and it was a good time. It was a good time.
Are you appropriately rested?
You know what? We, Southwest Airlines, I wish that they would be circumcised by 1,000 desert fleas. The last six flights that I've taken with them have, every single one of them has been late. And we ended up traveling for like 24 hours and we didn't get back to Chico until like 4 a.m. And then I had a jujitsu class not too long after that. And I was praying for death. And so I have no warm feelings for Southwest, and I'm actually kind of wrecked still after the whole thing. So,
nice.
I'm coming back, but if my sleep is pretty consistent, food's consistent, I feel really good. Training's good, performance is good, recovery's good. A night of 3.5 hours of sleep absolutely took me down at the kneecaps, so that was no fun.
Well, I mean, we have a doozy of an episode today, Rob. So I think it's good that you're, not fully here, just so we can spin you out.
I can claim that it was all my sleep deprivation. Yeah, I'm a little scared by this episode. It is the beefiest episode I think you've ever thrown together. So, eesh.
Well, I had a lot of coffee, today. I had a brief vacation last week. We were super ahead on the episode, so we gotta have a doozy today. I'm excited about this, Rob.
Oh, God help me. Okay, here we go.
And you can always pass. We should come up with
I take the fifth on this question.
Yeah, or we'll delay it to next week. I'm scared to answer this today, Andy. So anyway, all right, off to the question. So first, we got a question from Big Easy. He says, I have a question about heavy metal allergies. A client was informed by her doctor that she has a nickel allergy. Because of this, she not only has to avoid certain jewelry, not my problem, but also some super healthy foods like salmon, shellfish, sweet potatoes, carrots, broccoli, etc. Common sense says, okay, we can do this. It wasn't until the doctor recommended she increase her white bread intake. My question is, can we expect her to return to normal foods after an extended time on the paleo diet? Also, is there any way to speed the process along? In other words, supplementation. Thank you.
This one was kind of an interesting one to research. The how to jump in on this this deal. Nickel is actually a kind of sort of vital for certain enzymatic activity. So even though it's a heavy metal, and usually we associate heavy metal like cadmium, lead, nickel with toxicity, and indeed nickel does have both toxicity and pretty serious allergic properties, it is also important for some enzymatic functioning. It's kind of important for life. It's very, very rare, virtually impossible, or super rare, hardly ever seen in literature that somebody ends up with a nickel deficiency, but there are certainly some problems with a nickel allergy and nickel toxicity. So this recommendation from the doctor to avoid certain foods, the only thing on the list that is actually pretty high up in general with actual nickel content is the shellfish, which if we go to a website that I pulled up, and we can stick this in the show notes, melissa.org/nickel.php. We have a list of foods that mention high, medium, and low content foods. But the irony with this is that there is more variation on this. If you do a little bit more research, there's more variation in this than there is consistency. Like dark chocolate is listed as being a high nickel content, cocoa powder, licorice, lots of nuts. But the interesting thing is that grains and legumes tend to be very, very high relatively in nickel content. But then this is almost 100% dependent on just nickel content of the soil that they're grown in. So you have a huge variation on this whole problem, depending on where you're located and what type of foodstuffs you're ingesting. The interesting thing that the doctor didn't address, or I'm assuming that the doctor didn't address, is that nickel content of water has 25 or 30 times more likelihood of being absorbed than any type of food content. So if you were to look at dietary interventions to look at a reducing nickel intake, I would look first at your municipal water supply if you're drinking standard tap water and see if you're like high, medium, low nickel content. And that's kind of a one thing. And if you have a high nickel content water source, then getting some sort of a filter that removes heavy metals, you know, or doing bottled water or something like that would be a really smart idea, because the, you know, water is a much more likelihood of it increasing your nickel content in your body than food is. Then when we get to the food, there's some interesting stuff where like high iron or zinc content foods tend to inhibit the absorption of nickel out of the meal. So let's say that you were going to eat some shellfish, even though the shellfish is listed as a very high you know, nickel content food. If you were to eat something like spinach or even combine some red meat into the meal that has some iron, then you're going to create some competitive inhibition of the nickel content that's in that meal, actually making it through the gut and getting into your body. So there's some strategies that you could do with that as far as eating some high iron or zinc content foods. But then it still is going back to, you know, you don't really know for sure what the nickel content of the food that you're supposed to be eating. Nowhere do I see sweet potatoes or carrots or broccoli really being listed as high nickel content foods in all the resources that I looked up. So I'm not sure where her doctor is pulling this stuff from. Again, that melissa.org/ I think nickel was what it was, and we will put it in the show notes. melissa.org/nickel.php. That's a good place to look, but it's just the take home from this is like it's really hard to know what the nickel content is of most of your foodstuffs. There are some resources that describe like regional areas that have high nickel content to their soil, and so if you're getting like some farmers market type stuff from those locations, you might have some problems. If you live in like near industrial areas, crematoriums and fun stuff like that, then the nickel content of your atmospheric exposure can be rather high. So there's a whole bunch of other stuff that you know has more bearing on whether or not you're getting a high nickel intake than the foods that the doctor specifically listed there. And then as to whether or not, you know, eating a paleo diet is going to fix this, the answer is really no. It's you minimize your environmental exposure, which the main environmental exposure is actually like jewelry and earrings and stuff like that. Then the next layer of exposure is water. Next layer is looking at, do you live in any type of an environmental circumstance in which atmospheric nickel would be rather high? And then really you get down to the food, and then there's some strategies with the food, maybe looking at decreasing the foods that are legitimately considered to be high in nickel, try to figure out what your locality is. And then finally, if you want to, you could try doing some stuff in which you eat some high zinc, iron containing foods with, you know, most meals. And then you are at least somewhat insured of some competitive inhibition of the absorption of a nickel out of that meal. And if that makes any sense, then props to you. Any questions, Annie?
There are so many more ones on here that I can dig and cause a ruckus. And I'm, frankly, I don't have anything insightful to add to this one, Rob. I'm going to save all my comments for later. I mean, Great. We're already at 9 minutes in, so I think we're good.
Yeah, and that was one of the easier ones to answer, I have a feeling, out of this whole thing. So,
question two comes from Brian. Rob, have you come across any good literature that you can dig up about prevention of male hair loss? I'm 23 with a decent set of hair, would like to keep it, although it's been thinning a bit the past year. I do a lot of strength-based training and sometimes worry about the elevated testosterone levels impeding hair growth. What do you think?
This one is actually going to provide a little bit of synergy with a later question that talks about testosterone versus dihydrotestosterone and the kind of anabolic versus androgenic effects and prostate cancer and some different stuff like that. But it's understood that dihydrotestosterone, which in our whole kind of androgen milieu, you know, we've got progesterone and estrogen, and under estrogen we have estradiol and different families or subgroups of estrogenic compounds. Then we have testosterone, and testosterone can flow into dihydrotestosterone. It's understood that dihydrotestosterone plays some sort of a role in hair loss. Like there's a Rogaine and the products like that that are used as a topical, preventative in male pattern baldness, male hair loss. It actually blocks the activity of dihydrotestosterone on the hair follicles. But the interesting thing, even beyond this, is that some work that Cordain has dug up and some other people have dug up is that you need a state of hyperinsulinism to really induce this hair loss. So it's not so much the dihydrotestosterone. What we're seeing is much more of an issue of increased levels of androgen, the sex hormone binding protein, it ends up dropping, which increases testosterone transiently, but then testosterone can cascade into estrogen, particularly under circumstances of elevated fat mass and hyperinsulinism. So we get a cascading effect of testosterone into estrogen, and what we find is that it's more an issue of estrogen being kind of a precipitating agent in this whole process. So high dihydrotestosterone can be problematic, but it's really not that big a deal unless we have a hyperinsulinemic state and a situation in which our testosterone to estrogen ratio is starting to go south on us. So normally, if you're male, then we want a high degree of testosterone relative to estrogen. With aging to some degree, although I don't totally buy that, we would call it Western aging. With Western aging, we see a shifting in which the testosterone level drops and estrogen level increases, and that is really the big issue. And part of what is going on with that is some underlying hyperinsulinism. So the being worried about propping your testosterone levels up, androgen levels up, via smart training, I think that's a misplaced concern. But if you have diet and lifestyle issues that are leading into hyperinsulinism, which could lead into a conversion of testosterone into estrogen, that is definitely a concern in my opinion. And when we get down to that other question, we'll tie back into this. But for the short run, just this analysis of like hair loss, I wouldn't worry about your androgen levels other than trying to make sure that you're not converting testosterone into estrogen.
Well said.
Maybe.
Maybe. Never mind. Next question from Vinny. Hey, Rob and Annie, thanks for another good podcast. I have a real short and sweet question for you that might involve a bit of a long answer. Little does Vinny know, in Rob's world, there's no such thing as a short answer. But anyway, I eat pretty strict paleo in the hopes to flip my body composition and reach the ever-elusive look-good-naked status. Eggs, chicken, and green veggies are my mainstay, with different kinds of fish and the occasional beef thrown in now and then. I love spicy foods. In order to keep my palate tamed, I use a lot of hot sauce on my meals. Almost every meal, I find myself reaching a bottle of the stuff to spice things up a bit. The only sauces I use list the ingredients as peppers, vinegar, and salt. Is it really that simple? And will the use of these condiments or the ingredients therein slow down my or any other's progress in the quest for rippling abs and a beastly Fran time? And would they lead to any kind of inflammatory or leaky gut issue? Any info on other sauces or condiments that are safe or dangerous would be much appreciated. Thanks for sharing your knowledge. Your 20th listener. Thank you, Vinny.
And we know that double-digit listenership is not possible, so we'll just bypass that.
I saw that on Facebook. That's the whole half the reason Vinny's question is in here. Anyway.
The long and short of this is that, you know, like some really good hot sauces, they really do kind of boil down to like peppers, vinegar, salt, maybe some garlic in there. Can these things contribute to leaky gut issues? Yeah, they can. I mean, capsaicin and some of the products out of the nightshades, the peppers, tomatoes, and all that, they can and do cause some gut irritation. Different people have different degrees of susceptibility to this. And, you know, like as big a geek as I am on the gluten side of stuff, I really like hot food. Like I do some damage on myself occasionally with like jalapenos and with different types of hot sauce. I'm a little bit more moderate about it than what I used to be in the past, but it's kind of one of those, for me, kind of quality of life deals. Like I don't necessarily, how do I put this? It somewhat similar, I guess, to the gluten gig. You know, it's like I can make an argument, go 30 days without the item, see how you look, feel, and perform, reintroduce, see how it all plays out. The nightshades and kind of hot food stuff, I don't see it affect people to the degree that I see grains, legumes affect people. If somebody has an autoimmune condition, or if they already have some pretty rampant systemic inflammation, then yeah, I'm probably going to recommend that they go, you know, the standard kind of 30-day intervention, removing all that stuff, and then we reintroduce it. Just go, you know, try the shotgun approach. But it's just one of those orders of magnitude things. I just don't see the hot foods causing as much of a problem. Could they be a problem for somebody? Yeah, they totally could be. Is there different degrees of susceptibility? Yeah, there definitely is. But for me personally, it's kind of a quality of life deal, and I'm willing to kind of gamble a little bit because I like that stuff so much. So that's I would just kind of play around with it and see how you react with it. If you're dealing with somebody, say like you're a coach or a trainer, and you have a new client, and they definitely have some serious inflammation, and you know, maybe even are diagnosed with an autoimmune condition, you might recommend that they, you know, in addition to removing grains and legumes, might recommend, hey, you know, hot foods, tomatoes, potatoes, eggplant type things, try pulling those out of the rotation for a month as well, then reintroduce them and see how you do.
Yep. Dang nightshades.
So yummy, so dangerous.
Well, and if for those who haven't read it, and if you're not on Cordain's little email mailing list, they had like a 3-part series on nightshade foods recently, so definitely check that out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, moving on. Question from Christian. Hi, Rob. I'm 40 years old. I've been strict paleo on the very, very, very low carb side for 2 years. I've been feeling great all the time, though I suffered a lot of background stress in my life, which may have contributed to less than optimal sleep, though I do tend to sleep until I wake up, and maybe a bit of undereating and overcaffeinating, 2 to 3 double espressos per day. My workouts consist of a weekly session of Devaney-style heavy lifting in a fasted state, daily kettlebell swings for 5 minutes, and a long walk every now and then. I'm lean. I see my abs, though nothing remotely like Martin Burkham, lean gains guy, who we can never say his name. I'm tall and rather skinny. I'd be skinny fat without paleo. I recently got some blood tests done, and I was surprised to see an A1C value of 5.4. To put this in context, my fasting glucose was 91, 95 a month earlier, and insulin was 4.1. C-reactive protein was 0.20 at a test 1 month earlier. Blood lipids were also fine. Any comments on my alarmingly high A1C would be greatly appreciated, and thanks so much for a great show, from which I'm learning a ton every week. And then on the blog, Rob, you responded back, Christian, that is only a bit elevated sleep. And Christian followed up with, sleep is good so far as I do sleep undisturbed and don't wake up to alarm clock, but I'm not sure if sleep quality is super great. I feel rather grumpy in the morning. I can add that my body seems generally very eager to go in a flight or fight mode with raised pulse, blood pressure, adrenaline, and I assume cortisol plus glucose release. I've theorized that I've been a bit on the under-eating side for a while, as well as eating too late in the evening, 1 to 2 hours for bed, which may have contributed as a stressor. I rarely seem to feel hunger at all.
So when I look at this with the information that we have here, like the C-reactive protein is pretty darn good. So like systemic inflammation is not bad. So I'm thinking, you know, he probably is doing okay with regards to dietary carbohydrate content and quality. Like I'm not sniffing out any type of like a food allergy, gluten intolerance, you know, something like that. But definitely that A1C of 5.4 is a little bit on the high side. Like you would think that this stuff would be coming into a little bit tighter convergence, but I'm looking at this, I'm guessing that probably nutrition is okay, and I think the stress, he said that his sleep was pretty good, but if he's generally kind of wound tight, then you can end up with a chronically elevated blood glucose level just like all day long. It is like you had a jar of peanut M&Ms sitting there and you're just noshing on them, only it would be a lot more fun to eat the peanut M&Ms and not be stressed. So I would really look at this as kind of a lifestyle management deal. It's interesting, like eating a little bit earlier and it actually going to bed a little bit on, maybe not quite hungry, but you know, not food immediately in the stomach, you tend to have a more restful sleep, so it tends to be a more restorative sleep, you get a better kind of pulsatile growth hormone release. I see good stuff happening with that. And if he's waking up kind of foggy and grumpy, we definitely might have some cortisol management issues. So like all the standard lifestyle stuff, like making sure that the training is smart, which it sounds pretty good, make the food consistent, maybe try to wrap up that final meal by like 5, 6 p.m. and then see if that improves the sleep quality at night. Go for like some natural calm to aid the sleep a little bit and see if you generally start feeling better, and then maybe check up with this month or so down the road. Could definitely do an ASI test or some other screen for the adrenal kind of status and see how things are going with that. If that is the problem, if you do a little bit of lifestyle mod, maybe even you know, throughout the day, setting a timer and maybe every 2 hours or something, doing 5 minutes of kind of meditative, like deep breathing type stuff to really bring the stress levels down. If that's the issue, then we should see some resolution in this problem within a month, 2 months. You need to have enough time doing this to allow the A1C to go down. It changes kind of slowly. It's kind of a 30, 90, 120-day snapshot of what's going on based on the turnover of the red blood cells. So it's not going to be like a weekly change in the A1C is not going to be that noticeable. You need to check a little bit longer scale, but you should see things change for the positive if that's what's going on.
Yes, and for me, I think I would play with the, you know, N equals 1, but for me, some of this stuff sounds a little like I am periodically where caffeine tends to impact a bunch of other stuff, and I end up with raised pulse, blood pressure, adrenaline, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So something to consider. But then again, you know, like I always say, my dad hasn't had a drop of caffeine in 30 years because he's so sensitive to it. So even
right.
though I go through phases where I drink a lot of it and then don't drink any of it, I definitely notice some of those effects. So it could be something to play with.
Yeah, and you know, the caffeine deal is pretty interesting. And just coming off of vacation, it's just so fascinating. Like if I get to sleep in and I don't really have any deadlines, I don't have any emails I need to get back to, basically my basal stress level is low, I can drink a ton of coffee. Mm. And like I just feel fine. It doesn't really affect me. I don't get the rapid heart rate. I don't get the sweaty palms. You know, it's like really legitimately hard for me to overdo it. But if I have, even knowing that, say, like I've got the podcast brewing and like I need to prep for that and I need to look at the show notes to make sure that, you know, I've got my notes straight and my ideas straight. I've got some emails to deal with. I've got a deadline on another chapter with the book. If I've got that stuff percolating, it is easy for me to overdo my caffeine intake. And so I think it's very reflective of kind of where you are at your base level stress. The unfortunate reality is, like, I think all of us, you know, I think my lifestyle is probably a lot less stressful than a lot of other people. You know, we don't have kids yet, and I really enjoy the stuff that I'm doing. So even though it's kind of demanding and I have to be on the ball all the time, I actually like the stuff that I'm doing. Whereas a lot of people, like, they, you know, they're doing work that they just fundamentally don't like, and there's all kinds of stress associated with that. So I think keeping an eye on what your lifestyle has to offer really influences your ability to tolerate or not tolerate the caffeine. And then if you're already a little bit overextended on the lifestyle side, then the caffeine, it just takes you down at the kneecaps. And like Matt Lalonde has played with this a lot, and he's just like, man, it just is a no-win scenario for him. You know, like rapid heart rate, eyes blurring, you know, sweaty hands, the whole deal. He's got an obvious like over expression of kind of adrenaline and cortisol related to caffeine.
Yep. But man, it tastes good.
Damn, doesn't it? Yep.
I think I need to wean myself back off it again. But anyway. good question, and thank you. I love when we get follow up on the blog after you've commented things, Rob. I think that's cool. So,
well, and if he ends up tweaking, you know, playing with this stuff, then definitely let us know. It'd be really interesting for additional follow up.
Yes, absolutely. Next, we had a question from Tyler. He says, "Hey, Rob, got another question about lactose. I'm still rocking on the mass gain cycle and whole milk. Currently moving from about 170 in early March at sectionals to about 185 to 190." Showing awesome gains across all lifts. Snatch has gone from 185 to 210. Anyway, enough boasting. As stated in my last post to you about the lactase enzyme, are you typing, Rob?
Yeah.
Stop it.
Okay.
As you stated about the lactase enzyme supplements, I am semi-lactose intolerant. However, I choose to use dairy to put on some weight. I seem to notice that if I drink milk on an empty stomach or with a meal, it just destroys my stomach, no matter what. However, if I manage to chug the stuff down within 30 minutes after training, voila, no irritation. I can drink seemingly unlimited amounts of milk post-workout with no problem at all. Since lactose is a sugar, are my muscles, liver stealing the stuff away before it has a chance to affect my gut? Why am I able to tolerate milk after training? What's the mechanism behind this? Keep fighting the good fight. And then he has a link to High Fat Nutrition, who I can't remember who writes that blog, but
the hyperlipid guy.
Yeah,
it's fully legit. Like that, yeah. That's an awesome blog. Yeah, yeah.
So Rob, where are you at with this one?
This one is interesting, and I don't have a real solid answer on it. Like I did a ton of research. Like the whole issue of, you know, like post-workout improved glucose uptake, it doesn't really have bearing on this because the lactase enzyme is happening in the brush border of the gut. And so that's not really the issue here. I did a lot of poking around trying to figure out it. You know, some people have absolutely no expression of lactase when they're an adult. Some people maintain it all throughout life. Some people maintain it conditionally based on consistent intake of a lactose source, and then if they stop taking in lactose, then they lose the ability to deal with the lactose. And I honestly don't know what's going on with this. We can do some more digging, but there is some interesting stuff. Like, but again, this is on like more of this like muscle cell level. Part of the problem with statins when we are training is that the same lactate shuttles that move lactose out of cells and actually part of the Cori cycle back into the liver and all that stuff, the some of the statins get selectively brought into muscle cells under heavy training conditions. And so there is definitely, like, when the body has been put through the ringer and it's been trained very hard, it is definitely looking for any type of a fuel substrate to pump in and be utilized for recovery. And lactose is too, you know, a two sugar molecule of galactose, and so it would be great to get that stuff into the system for some recovery. But I really don't know what's going on with that. Like I did a ton of Googling around, looked on PubMed. I'm not seeing anything that seems to indicate like an upregulation of the lactase enzyme in response to just exercise. So I'll do some more poking around on this. It's kind of interesting. I'm not really too sure what's going on with this.
Yes, my only addition is check out the High Fat Nutrition, like that guy's blog, and there's his most recent post from June 26 is that Gwyneth Paltrow has osteoporosis.
That's
the beginning
good
stages, which is awesome. And if anyone knows who Gwyneth Paltrow's trainer Tracy Anderson is, or if you don't, put her into Google and watch some videos of perhaps the most idiotic exercise program I've ever seen.
Yeah, that's the whole deal where, like, females, Gwyneth's idea is that females should not lift more than 5 pounds. And, like, she plays around with these ribbons on, like, these spindles and stuff. It is pure insanity. It is amazing.
And my favorite part is when she's like, I'm not allowed to lift more than 5 pounds, but my one kid weighs more than 30 pounds. So this arm's much bigger. So we just do a lot more reps of 5 pounds on that side or on the other side. And I'm like,
but the kid doesn't count as weight,
apparently. Yeah, apparently. I'm like, you are an idiot. Thank you for sharing your health knowledge with the world. But anyway, moving on. I could yell about Tracy Anderson for an hour. I've had enough caffeine today. So we're going to move on to our friend Keith from Theory to Practice. Keith, I'm sorry I've had a lot of caffeine today, not a lot of sleep, so I'm spun up more than usual. But good question. So something I'd love for you guys to cover in a future podcast. Mike Mahler, parentheses, who I'm agree with more times than not, close parentheses, maintains that DHT is actually the grand poobah anabolic hormone and that high levels in an otherwise clean hormonal profile are desirable. A plug into the testosterone DHT optimization question and the discussion of paleo's effect on this ratio would be much appreciated. A friend of the family's has recently been diagnosed with prostate cancer, and as you might imagine, DHT is spoken of rather poorly around the old kitchen table. I'm quite sure that high DHT levels are not the problem, but another something that is in the environment of a high DHT level that's the real root of the evil. Love to hear your thoughts on this. Thanks again for the enjoyable string of shows, guys.
A really good question, and it's a interesting topic for sure. So it's something to ask oneself in the circumstance of prostate cancer. It's very, very interesting because both testosterone and dihydrotestosterone, DHT, are vilified. Like they are implicated as the causative factors in prostate cancer. But interestingly, when we look at epidemiological studies, we see absolutely no, like none, prostate cancer in young, healthy males who have pubescent levels of testosterone. And there's this kind of weird thing that goes on in some of the health community. And there's a statement, if you fish around a little bit, you'll track down the statement that is, if a male lives long enough, he will develop prostate cancer at some point, which is very scary and kind of cryptic and like, oh my God, what's going on with this stuff? And so that's just a little bit to like ruminate on for a second, and then we'll back up here. When we're talking about testosterone and DHT, it's important to distinguish between anabolic effects and androgen effects. And anabolic effects are growth related, and then androgen it refers more to like, you know, sex differential and stuff like that, male versus female. DHT actually plays a significant role in embryological development and is part of why male fetuses end up developing into, you know, developing the male characteristics that they do. And malfunctions in DHT signaling during embryological development can also cause some problems with mismatched gender versus genetic imprinting. So like an individual can look like they're female, but actually be XY chromosome because of some problems with DHT signaling in utero. So it's really, really important. It's very broad reaching. But when we're looking at the importance of these hormones from like kind of a health longevity standpoint, testosterone definitely plays a bigger role in muscle mass accretion. Like there is no doubt about that. It is more anabolic in the sense of growing muscle mass. But the interesting thing about DHT is that it has very potent androgen effects. It works on the central nervous system. It improves focus, to some degree aggression, but that's kind of a misnomer. It's actually more focus, the ability to recruit large muscle mass. So it has huge influences on strength. And if you start reading it all about anabolic steroids, this is where there are certain steroids that have very potent androgen effects and are much more strength-oriented, and then there are others that are more anabolic or more, you know, just kind of muscle volumizing a growth influencer. So it's really important to understand the distinction there. I would kind of make the argument, and maybe this is kind of what Mike Mahler's his point on this, if you want to feel good, have quick cognition, be creative, assuming you're male, this is all kind of male-oriented, then you want good DHT levels. If you want good sex drive, you want good neurological innervation to the musculature, you want to have good eye-hand coordination, you want to be witty and productive, then you want your DHT levels to be good. So those are kind of the two profiles for the two different hormones. Now, when we start looking again at prostate cancer, what's interesting is that individuals with high, above average testosterone, dihydrotestosterone, don't typically develop prostate cancer. And this is known, it's fully understood. What we start seeing as a causative factor is actually a shift in the testosterone-estrogen ratio, which we talked about this a little bit in the previous question related to hair loss. I think really what's going on here, and the people whom I respect on this topic who've looked into it, what I think is going on here is, again, a shifting away from a healthy, normal testosterone, dihydrotestosterone profile, and a conversion of testosterone into estrogen, and estrogen actually playing a primary role as a mitogenic agent or a growth-promoting agent. Embryologically, the prostate plays exactly the same role, or not the same role, but it is derived embryologically from the same tissue that would be analogous to the uterus in the female. And it's understood very clearly that uterine fibroid growth, uterine cancers are an extension of abnormal estrogen levels. Like, this is very clearly understood. These are the same tissues. They have the same types of receptor sites in them in the prostate tissue, and they respond to the same environmental triggers. So when a male's normally low estrogen levels start going up, then we start getting a mitogenic or a growth-promoting effect. And it's very, very interesting. Testosterone and dihydrotestosterone actually play antagonistic roles to growth in the prostate under normal circumstances. And then even as a standalone item, if we look at the general profile of each one of these hormones, estrogen is a known mitogenic agent. It's a known growth agent. Testosterone does not have a mitogenic profile, and DHT only has a very mild mitogenic profile. So it's really unfortunate. It's kind of a tragedy. The standard of care for prostate cancer oftentimes is a high-dose estrogen bolus, which in the short run slows down prostate cancer growth, but then in the long run it inevitably ends up selecting for a very aggressive prostate cancer cell lines. Essentially, it doesn't really do folks any good. A lot of criticism around the prostate cancer therapy that is standard of care. In Sweden, this whole process, whether it was radiation, whether it was chemo, whether it was hormone treatment, was compared with people who did no intervention at all. And the treatment protocols provided no extension in life at all. But it was expensive, and it definitely decreased the quality of life. So even from let's just say there's no way that we can intervene in this scenario and get any type of positive effects, which I think is not true. I'll talk about that in a second. But let's just say that's true for a second. At a baseline, doing nothing appears to be as effective as the treatment with regards to survivability, and you have much better quality of life. Everybody understands that. Like, these individuals are able to maintain normal sexual function. They're not sick from the chemotherapy, radiation, and hormone treatments, and so the quality of life is just better all the way around. But there are some doctors out there that are pretty savvy to the role of progesterone and dihydrotestosterone and testosterone, blocking the conversion of testosterone into estrogen, largely by nutritional interventions, which end up dropping the fat mass. When we decrease the fat mass, then our main source of aromatization of testosterone into estrogen is blocked. And then if these individuals are deficient in progesterone or dihydrotestosterone, DHT, then there can be some mild low-dose supplementation that can bring that stuff back into good parameters. There's some really good results with that stuff. And an interesting thing is that progesterone, one of the main causes of decreased progesterone in males, is actually elevated cortisol levels. So overtraining, stress, lack of sleep, all that sort of stuff starts playing into a synergistic fashion here. So this problem is wickedly complex. Like, I could get in and look at prostate cancer from a hyperinsulinemic perspective and look at elevated estrogen levels due to decreased sex hormone binding protein. We could look at this from an omega-3, omega-6 standpoint and look at a prostaglandin cascades that feed into abnormal cell growth and inflammation. We can look at this from a hormonal level of both abnormal testosterone related to estrogen levels. feeding into a mitogenic state of, or a growth-promoting state. And then we've got this confounding factor that normally progesterone is playing a growth-arresting factor in any type of precancerous situations with prostate. So, like, this thing just gets wickedly complex, and it's, again, where this integrated lifestyle approach is absolutely the best way to go. And then if there are some pieces to that puzzle that are not falling into the parameters that we need, then we can start looking at getting some help from our medical community to pull them back into place. Low-dose progesterone, low-dose testosterone, or DHT supplementation. But again, your primary focus needs to be a lifestyle and nutrition that is actually supportive of this whole scene.
Good question, and a plug for Keith Norris's blog, theorytopracticewordpress.com. Fantastic blog.
Outstanding blog, yeah.
Yes. All right. Moving on, question from E. Hayes says, question about animal fat. Also, we removed the first part of the question. It was already answered. Anyway, still wondering if you could elaborate on saturated fat from animal sources. You've made it very clear the difference in polyunsaturated omega-3 and omega-6 in animal fat and how it affects us. Is there a difference between pastured and grain-fed saturated fats other than there being more of it in grain-fed? How does saturated fats affect humans? What does it become in the body? Thanks for the feedback. Can't wait for the book.
So what's our first legit question here? Is there a difference between pastured and grain-fed saturated fats?
Correct.
Generally, you just end up with more saturated fat from grain feeding, and typically in the form of palmitic acid, which we've talked about before. Palmitic acid can cause some problems with the regards to the brain being able to interpret or get the signal from leptin that there should be satiety, that we've eaten and we don't need to eat anymore. And there's some potential for palmitic acid to cause some problems there. And then beyond that, we've got the saturated fats that we're typically going to see, like lauric acid, a palmitic acid, a stearic acid, all these things are interchangeable to some degree. Like, they can be elongated, they can be desaturated, they can do a ton of different stuff in the body. They can't be converted into the essential fats, the omega-3, omega-6 families of fats, but they can be interconverted quite a bit outside of that situation. So how saturated fat affects humans, depending on how much of it you have in your cell membranes, there's definitely an argument for maybe having more of it in the diet because it tends to be less oxidizable, tends to cause less problems with reactive oxygen species, and that's a good thing from like a cellular aging standpoint and oxidative damage standpoint. The effect that saturated fat has on cholesterol is really pretty nebulous. Like, the palmitic acid appears to raise LDL cholesterol, but then that is mainly an issue if we're in a hyperinsulinemic state. If you're generally eating along this kind of paleo primal kind of guideline, it's really just not that big a deal. Interestingly, saturated fat, particularly like stearic acid, actually lowers a marker of systemic inflammation, apolipoprotein A, and it actually helps boost levels of good cholesterol, HDL cholesterol. So it does a ton of different things. The main thing that we're trying to avoid here, if there's really even that much of an impetus to avoid it, is the palmitic acid that would be higher from a grain feeding. And then keep in mind also, when we're talking grain versus grass-fed meat, we're also looking at a very different omega-3, omega-6 profile. We're also looking at vastly different amounts of things like conjugated linoleic acid, alpha-lipoic acid, meat or fat associated carotenoids and antioxidants that just are not virtually non-existent in a grain-fed scenario. So the differences between grain and grass-fed are far, far reaching beyond simply the saturated fat issue.
Yep. All right, good question.
Yeah.
All right, Rob, we got one of the fun questions for the day.
Andy D is stirring up problems.
For the listeners, before Rob and I started recording, we had like a 30-minute discussion about like gym stuff. So I feel like question eight is something Rob and I could like talk about for 15 hours over tequila and never come to a conclusion. But we're going to let Rob take a crack at it. I'm excited about this.
great, and just ensure that a sniper someday like takes out my tires while rounding a corner. So
whatever.
It's not your life, Andy. It's mine.
Rob, I'm in the Mike Boyle. Just because you disagree with people doesn't mean you dislike them camp, you know. So if these people can't handle your opinions, I'm sorry, but we will work on getting you a bulletproof, you know, 740 IL, and see if we can get someone to drive you around Chico.
Perfect. Okay, I'm into that. But you know, Mike Boyle is of the flavor of quality of human being that he, you know, he can be pragmatic about that and say, well, if you disagree with me, that's fine. The folks we're going to talk about, if you disagree with them, then apparently you hate them. So
hence the 740 IL. I'll talk to Nikki. We'll, you know, we'll see what we can do. We'll take up a donation at the gym for you.
Great. Okay.
It'll only take 30 years to get you a 740 IL. Anyway.
Perfect.
Question from Wayne. Another great podcast. Love the whiteboard reference and the last question and your commentary on it. I found the elite attitude that many in the CrossFit area push just a big freaking turnoff. Don't get me started on the CrossFit Games and the fittest person on the planet either. But a good thing to talk about is, what exactly is fitness? I know a lot of it is relative, but a client or a potential client came into you and asked, Rob, I want to be fit. What do I need to do? How would you answer that question? You and Andy keep up the good work. Thanks.
The big one. You know, it's I still tend to be very much the generalist. Like, I like that generalist place. It's a lot of what attracted me to CrossFit originally. And I'm going to end up having a couple of different definitions here. You know, like Dan John has a definition that he throws around of fitness that is being able to do the thing that you want to do. Like, if you're a discus thrower or a hammer thrower, you need to be fit to throw the discus or the hammer. And there are certain things that go into that, a good degree of maximal strength, but also probably even more emphasis on like rate of force development type stuff. You know, unilateral work, prehab based on all the rotational overload that you're experiencing in those things. For an MMA fighter, then we've got a much broader a repertoire of skills I think you would need to develop, you know, anaerobic capacity, aerobic capacity, balance coordination, you know, just a ton of different stuff. But I really like, you know, for that definition of fitness, I do kind of like that idea that you could drop in and kind of more or less do a C-minus level at pretty much anything. And maybe you've got some B-plus, A-minus characteristics at some stuff, and then, you know, some okay things at other things. I think this idea that you would, you know, develop the, what was it, the novice capacity of an 800 meter runner, a gymnast, and a O-lifter, but the reality of that, you know, it's great in verbiage, but the reality is, like, you know, to develop a D-level capacity of a gymnast is a 2 or 3 year endeavor of simply gymnastics, you know, and then from there, it starts layering on capacity type stuff that maybe is more narrow in scope, you know, like specifically running and all that. I really like the Move Nat stuff that I've talked to Irwan about, which is a really heavy focus on capacity built of technical proficiency. So instead of driving people into failure to build capacity, you know, drive the train from a perspective of technical proficiency, and then when you attain technical proficiency at a, you know, we'll use an arbitrary range here, but you know, an A level move, or let's say a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being simple, 10 being complex, when you master a complexity issue level 1, instead of beating that level 1 to death, say like a push-up or something like that, let's start building some capacity in 2s and 3s and 4s and 5s and work towards a 10. I wrote an article about this for the performance menu years ago, looking at this from kind of a multi-dimensional standpoint. You know, like a pull-up is good, a weighted pull-up is better, an L-sit pull-up I think would be better yet, an L-sit pull-up in which you have a weight that is held between your feet, I would kind of argue would be like kind of the cat's meow all the way around, because because of the multidimensional nature, like you're getting so much stimulus out of that movement, it seems like it would be really good. And then from there, we're not even getting into like high bar swings and different stuff like that. So I know I'm getting kind of far afield on this deal, but you know, I like this idea of the broad general inclusive fitness, like that intuits really well to me. But I think the route that you go to get that, a focus on strength, on technicality, on mobility, and then building capacity in a stepwise and to some degree like an undulating or kind of periodized fashion, that makes a lot of sense to me. And it seems safe, it seems fun. I think it's all really good. You know, when I'm not sure if this ties in 100%, but one of the things the genius, and I will say genius, even though I know I'm completely reviled by like the HQ crowd, but there's some genius, I think, in this tying together of like, you know, what is CrossFit and the notion of functional movements, you know, that they're universal motor recruitment patterns, core to extremity, and then they tie into that idea of ability to move large loads, long distances quickly, and power output, and then tying power output into kind of a definition of fitness. I think there's some really cool stuff to that, and I think it's very insightful, but I also think that there needs to be some extension to that. I think there are some missed opportunities there. You know, like the LSIT is a perfect example. Doesn't move a large load, long distance, or quickly, but it sure is beneficial for integrating an individual and teaching them the degree of tightness necessary to actually, you know, squat and deadlift and thruster and do all that other stuff. So it's very, very interesting that the definition of kind of functional movements, the definition of power development, what is CrossFit, what is fitness, those things tie together, but yet some of the foundational tools of being able to get to that point, like the gymnastic skills, hollow rocks, supermans, front levers, back levers, they have absolutely nothing to do with large work output, but yet they are absolutely fundamental to the ability to acquire that. So there's a huge gap in the epistemology of that whole thing. Like there is a complete missing of some foundational development that is not work capacity related, and it gets addressed kind of on the slide. But there's such an emphasis on elite performance and everything, and kind of the hyperbole around that, that there's a lot being missed. But the reality is that good coaches think. They experiment, they tinker, they talk with other good coaches, they see what people are doing. So, I mean, you can have the ownership or the admin level saying one thing, but then the reality is that everybody in a very decentralized kind of libertarian fashion is doing exactly what they need to do to make this stuff work. So the hyperbole and the chatter doesn't really matter in that regard. But I think it's very interesting kind of where the whole thing has grown, and I'm very drawn to that generalist approach. I dig it. I like it. Kind of on a power bias orientation, but I started doing jiu-jitsu again. Like, I love doing that. This is kind of getting into that peak of the CrossFit hierarchical model, which is get out and learn and participate in new sports. I started learning how to dance, like salsa dancing and Lindy Hop and everything. And I tell you what, I sucked ass originally, but a couple of months in, like I'm getting reasonably good at it. Like, I had a good athletic background, and as I get more time doing that, I'm getting pretty good at it, and it's a ton of fun. But I don't know what type of work capacity that's building. And to get better at it, I would have to probably sacrifice some work capacity, but it is so damn much fun and so enjoyable. Who cares? You know, so where does that plug into fitness? Where does that plug into health and longevity? I would think that it's probably pretty damn important. You know, just understanding the neuroendocrine response of happiness is profoundly beneficial. So I know that gets kind of far afield, but it's a large topic, and hopefully I did it some decent treatment for Wayne's very, very good question.
And that leads us into a comment we got from Rod O'Hara, who, man, I love these ones. Just listened to the podcast yesterday, and something you said really bugged me. First off, I do not totally eat paleo. Many of my males are, but I have 5 kids with 1 on the way. I drive 1 hour plus each way to work and work shift work. Excuses, excuses, I know. But I love my mini cheats. Back to why I'm sending this message. You basically stated that pure CrossFit doesn't work. The way you quantified that was to point out that the great up-and-coming athletes that are beating out the long-time CrossFitters. I disagree. My thing is you need to compare the athletes to themselves. Are they still getting PRs regularly and not compare specific individuals? Either way, thanks for the podcast and info. Your podcasts sometimes keep me awake during the long commute. Good luck with the book. Thanks. And then I'm going to read your response on the blog, Rob, before we talk about it. So you responded, Rod, exactly. And folks are not following .com programming and progressing. That main page programming has been held up as the end-all be-all. Many others have argued it needs some tweaking in very specific ways if one is to progress long-term. That addresses your point. My main point is that we do not see other sports with the complete changing of the guard each year. Age may not remove some folks, but experience and skill set should be worth a ton. In CrossFit, we are not seeing this. Perhaps I'm wrong, but this is my observation after coaching this stuff for 7 to 8 years.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how much more to add to that. You know, it's just there was for a time a lot of, again, hyperbole about, like, you know, the dot-com programming was it was the end-all be-all. And if that's the case, then you wouldn't see people doing specialization series in max effort black box and in Olympic lifting. Like, if that was it, then that's it. And otherwise, you need to just simply acknowledge that shoring up weaknesses is outside the scope of what that program is offering. And it's that simple. But there was so much ego and hyperbole associated with that, that there could not be an acknowledgement of that. And then here again, you know, if we were to look back at triathlon finishes, say like top 10 state or national triathlon finishes, powerlifting finishes, pick any sport that you want, and see who is finishing, it's say like the top 10 or the top 100 over a 5-year period, you're going to see a very consistent you know, group of people at the top of the heap. And, you know, like Spieler is definitely still in there pretty good. Like, there are some people who are doing some very high work output, but you're seeing a remarkable changing of the guard. People who were at the absolute top of the heap are now getting displaced by these people who are literally brand new to the sport, but what they bring to bear on the whole thing is typically a remarkably sound strength and conditioning background. They've lifted weights, they've sprinted, they've jumped, they've tumbled, and typically they've competed at a high level in athletic endeavors, and then they come in and they do it, maybe even, you know, .com for a period of time, which essentially, like, if we were to break this down into old block periodization type stuff, this is a peaking regimen. It's an intermediate program. Ripito, you know, made the point that CrossFit, as it is generally practiced, is an intermediate program that is best served typically by a beginner's program that builds foundation in strength and in motor proficiency, and then we end up getting into the realm of sport for the you know, the people heading towards the CrossFit games. And I just think that it's intriguing that you do see this changing in the guard. Perhaps at some point we'll have kind of a deep enough penetration of people of sufficient athletic development and genetic talents that you see a similar bracketing that we see in other sports, where these people are on the scene again and again and again. But we just haven't really seen that yet.
Yep. I think my only comment about, you know, comparing athletes to themselves, they're still getting PRs regularly, not compare specific individuals. My old comment on that, the tough part about the body and strength and conditioning is that for a time period, everything freaking works, whether it's good or bad. And so it's like, this is a little far afield, but, you know, there's major strength and conditioning programs based around, like, high intensity training, one set to failure, machines only. Those people are still progressing. They play in the NFL. Like, I'm not going to use that as an argument for how I train, and so, or train my clients or athletes. So I feel like, are you getting PRs regularly is sort of a bad measurement as being the only thing you're using to argue why a program's effective or not.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, if you are getting PRs regularly, then I know that I'm talking to a novice.
Yep.
And that it's that simple, because when you've trained for years, you have to cycle your programming, and sometimes another PR is few and far between. I mean, Andy has mentioned some of the training, like Eric Cressy has some fairly public descriptions of like his deadlift training and stuff like that. And what he's near 700 pounds at a 165 body weight, 181 body weight.
Yep.
And his deadlift programming is periodized such that he will pull like a final heavy pull sometimes 2 months before he wants to compete. And then there's all this like intervening like doses of efforts that are basically just trying to keep that last big heavy signal going so that the supercompensation happens on or about the right time, and he's just avoiding detraining in the process. And it's wacky stuff, but you're talking about just world record elite performance. And so simply saying, are you still continuing to set PRs, doesn't really mean anything other than you're probably brand new with the stuff that you're doing.
Yep. All right, good comment. And last question of the day, Rob.
Oh, man.
We got a question from Barry. He says, hello again, Rob and Andy. I'm not even going to try to enter myself into the running for best handle since the competition has now gotten pretty fierce, so I'll just stick with my name. I've got two questions for you based on recent experiences. Just as a background, I've been eating paleo now since January after nearly 20 years of vegetarianism, although I've kept some butter, heavy cream, and whole milk into the mix, all raw, grass-fed, milk-only pre-workout. First of all, I know we're never supposed to get sick anymore once we switch to the paleo diet, but I did have an experience a few weeks back where I did get sick with some sort of stomach flu. It was then that I realized that almost all of what is generally recommended for calming the stomach is tremendously gut-irritating carbs, toast, crackers, etc. I obviously didn't want to go that route, but the regular meat, veggies, some fruits menu was really not something I could stomach at the time. So what do you recommend for paleo stomach-calming sick foods? I know last episode you mentioned ginger and a few other things. I also found that chicken broth went down surprisingly well.
I just really like soups, like that coconut milk pudding that Andy mentioned a couple of podcasts back, kind of almost like a paleo flan kind of gig, coconut milk with apples or whatever. Anything that's pretty chewed up, it's pretty heavily processed or broken into small pieces. Taking soup and making it a little on the thin side, and then pureeing it in a blender. When your gut gets damaged, it's harder to digest things. The brush border is not fully intact. All the enzymatic processes are not working well. So you really want to hedge your bets on the digestion. And then just because this food is liquid, it doesn't mean you should shotgun it. Like because the gut is impacted, you still want to chew it. You want to get as much exposure to digestive enzymes as you can. You want to introduce it slowly to the gut so that you can actually get something out of it.
Yes. And I don't know about that we're never supposed to get sick anymore.
Yeah, I don't know if anybody's ever said that. People comment they get sick a lot less, and I don't think anybody would argue with that, but I mean, it does not, unfortunately, turn you into Wolverine, so, yeah.
Man, it'd be cool if I was Wolverine, though, I gotta be honest. I could have the hair for it, for sure.
Shagadelic, for sure.
next question, he said, for at least the past month or more, I've noticed that I often get a runny nose after eating. At first, I thought it was just after my breakfast omelets covered in
Sriracha
sauce. Clearly, I don't eat that. Which could be explained by an autoimmune reaction to the eggs and just the spice of the hot sauce. However, I noticed that I seem to get the same reaction pretty much after every meal. For example, I got it last night after a dinner of roasted chicken legs and a roasted beets. Beets had grass-fed butter, everything else strict paleo. And I've even gotten it after a meal of nothing but buffalo patties, salmon patties, and avocados. It's nothing serious, but since it does seem to point to some sort of autoimmune response, I figured it was worth bringing up. Thanks for the great podcast.
There could be a little bit of gut permeability here, like a low-grade food reactivity. Like you could certainly do an allergy panel, and in addition to the allergy panel, some places will actually get into food and tolerance type stuff. The interesting thing is that when we've eaten gut-irritating foods in the past, then it's possible to then become sensitive to foods that would normally not be a gut irritant, like chicken and beef and all that sort of stuff. Undigested pieces of those larger proteins can make it into the system, and we can have some reaction to it. Another thing that you could do is just simply do some digestive support, like the No Food super enzymes, get a good probiotic going, and see if generally supporting the digestion, making sure to really chew your food. You know, I know James Fitzgerald, OPT, is a huge stickler on that. Taking the time to, like, chew your food very thoroughly, that can immediately improve the digestion, digestive quality, and then that may deal with the you know, little bit of kind of an allergic response that you might be getting out of this. But I would do some digestive support for sure. And if that doesn't work, then maybe you could start looking into an allergy or a food intolerance panel. Then from there, what you're going to need to do is the things that you aren't allergic to, you're going to have to work, you know, mainly with those foods, slowly reintroducing the other foods that you might have a problem with.
Yep. Good question.
Really good
Rob,
question.
Rob, that's it.
Oh, man.
An hour and 5 minutes. It's not too bad, actually.
I figured this one was going to be like 3 hours with all the testosterone-related questions, but I managed to trip and muddle my way through that. So,
well, and I committed to not incite riots here. You know, you have a lot of busy stuff going on, important questions to answer. We haven't yet got you to 740 IL. So, you know, I think you safely handled this barrage of questions this week.
Well, thank you. That's good.
And with that, Rob, that is the end of episode 36. Thank you very much for the time, and we'll talk to you next week.
Right on, Andy. Talk to you soon.
All right. See you, Rob.
Later.